First of all, welcome to the Unschlagbar Ehrlich podcast, Gregory Burns.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You are a special guest. Thanks for being here.
No, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, our listeners can't see it, but we are currently here on a pretty little island in the Maldives at the West Inn Resort in Mariando. And you probably didn't know what you will get yourself into when I asked you about the interview.
No, but I'm sure it'll be painless, so I'm not too scared.
Yeah, interviews are never painless.
No.
I'm good at torturing.
Good.
Today, we had a really, really nice day. We saw dolphins, we saw manta rays, and we were painting a picture under the sea.
Under the sea, yeah. It was wonderful to have this experience. It's called a Marriott moment, and we had four guests come to learn scuba diving for the first time in their life, and then to on top
of that, including me,
yeah, including you, which is great. And then on top of that, people were learned how to sketch underwater on a simple acrylic plate with a pencil. So two things that were, I think, a bit of a stretch for people, but everybody had a wonderful experience and a wonderful result.
It's actually ridiculous if you hear it, like swimming with manta rays and dolphins,
yeah,
and underwater world, and then sitting underwater and sketching something. It's,
yeah,
amazing.
It really is. I mean, this world is full of experiences, but this, the experience of being with being in nature, really enveloped by the sea and breathing underwater and being with dolphins and being with manta rays and fish and coral in the ocean, it's quite magical.
How did you come up with the idea to sketch underwater?
Well, I've been painting since I was 6 years old, so sketching and painting is my second nature. However, I started to scuba dive when I was in my late teens, so many decades ago, and gradually got to the idea, well, why don't I, when I'm underwater, try to draw what I see instead of just looking, or as some people do, take photographs. I decided to just use this very simple technique, which is to use a plate, white acrylic plate, and a pencil. And so I take it down and I sit on the bottom of the ocean or sit in the current, and usually I cross my legs and look at what I have to see, and just take the pencil and sketch what I see. So it's very basic technology, but it gives me the opportunity to draw and to focus on something while I'm underwater, and as I said, being part of the ocean. So that's a very special time.
And I think I have never been more in the moment than,
yes,
in this moment under sea.
Yeah, I believe that's part of it. Drawing does have a way of centering us and bringing us into the moment, as you say. And I think being centered and being under the ocean with the natural life there is really quite a special moment for us.
Yeah. So painting is something that has always been there in your life, as well as swimming, and this is a sports podcast, so we will talk a little bit more about swimming.
Right.
Your career as an athlete started as a 5-year-old boy in Washington, D.C., in the pool of the White House. Bam! What a big jump from Maldives to a 5-year-old Gregory at the White House.
Yeah, that's a big jump. I hadn't thought of it in those terms, but yeah, that's a big, it's a big jump.
But we are all jumping into the water.
Yes.
Yeah. You, your story is quite interesting. You went actually to Israel with your parents the year before,
yeah,
I think.
Well, actually, when I was a year old, or just less than a year, my father's first posting overseas was in Jerusalem. And we went there. I was actually 6 months old, and my older brother was 2 years. And after we were there a few months, I contracted polio, which we didn't know. This is before CNN and all this social media, so we didn't know there was a polio epidemic at the time. But I contracted polio, as did my brother. But he had the three, at the time, they were three vaccinations, and I had only had one. I had to wait. After the first one, you had to wait 6 months to get a booster. So while I was waiting to get my booster, I contracted polio in Israel, which pretty much left me paralyzed from the waist down. But anyway, we were in Jerusalem, then had to move back to America for treatment and went into Children's Hospital. And then, as you mentioned, went swimming in the White House pool, because that's what you do.
Yeah, because the doctors told your parents it's important to go into a warm water pool.
Yeah, that was the doctors were very very blunt. They said you'll never walk again, but also the best thing for a kid with polio would be to swim in a warm water pool. And we knew of no other warm water pool in Washington, D.C. at the time, except there happened to be one at the White House, which had been built for Franklin Delano Roosevelt, as you may recall, also had polio. Mm-hmm. So that was built for him and was still in operation when I went there.
Yeah, and you had the luck, actually, that your grandparent...
Yeah, my grandfather was an economist, and he had been doing some work for the Eisenhower administration. So now you know how old I am. but this is ages ago. But he had been doing some work for the Eisenhower administration. He knew Eisenhower's personal physician. And so he wrote a letter to him, and I have the letter. It says, you know, dear doctor, I forget his name, but my grandson Gregory got polio while my son was on posting in Jerusalem. Could he possibly use the White House pool? And this is long before 9/11. This is long before terrorism and things. And they said, sure. And my mother, my father, and I used to go to the White House regularly. And we'd have to go through the White House to get to what is now actually the press room. The press room didn't exist, but Nixon put boards or covered over the swimming pool and created what we know as today is the press room. So anyway, we had to go through the White House to get to the press room, to the swimming pool, and then we went swimming. My mother also tells a story. That was during Eisenhower's administration, and then she said that there was one day she was pushing my stroller through the White House, and I had a squeaky wheel and on my stroller, and she remembers going down the hall through the White House, looking in one of the doors and seeing at that time Kennedy had become president.
Wow.
So now we have Kennedy and his staff, and comes Gregory down the hall, and my mother, then we went swimming, and then the next day or shortly thereafter we got the letter saying that we would no longer be allowed to use,
no.
to use the swimming pool. So
do you think it was because of this wheel?
You know, I don't know if it was from the wheel or did perhaps Kennedy have other things he wanted to do in the swimming pool. I don't know. You know, it could have been that, or maybe there was some concern for his children, because polio, you know, was, as with COVID, you know, was a very scary thing, and people didn't know how to treat it and what were the precautions and things. So it was scary for sure. And he had children. And I could totally understand that, you know, if I had been president, I would have said the same thing. So I don't fault him for that.
Okay. But you stick with swimming. It was a part of your life, a very big part of your life. And what does it mean to you?
You know, swimming was freedom. I walk with braces and crutches. I'm on land using gravity, of course, as we all are subject to gravity. But when I get in the water, I don't have the gravity, if you will. And I my legs don't work, but my arms work very well. And so I can swim, you know, like a fish or a dolphin or whatever. And I was able to just to be free and enjoy myself and also train myself. So swimming was a playground at first, but then it became a training ground. So when I was about 18, I moved to California. I learned for the first time about what is called the Paralympics, or sports for people with disabilities. And it was for the first time in my life that I thought, oh my goodness, I could compete against someone on an even playing field instead of against able-bodied people with no disabilities. You know, although I did compete, if you will, I played football and baseball, soccer, basketball, you know, everything. But I didn't, it wasn't an even playing field. So I found out about sports for people with disabilities, and I tried all sports. I did swimming, but I also did everything. Yeah, javelin and ping pong and racing and basketball. And so I tried all sorts of sports, but I always just kept circling back to swimming, because that's where I did the best. And I immediately became nationally ranked in America and then internationally ranked. And so, I forgot the story about Brazil. Yeah, so the other thing when I learned about swimming and competing. The first swim, I learned there was a Pan American game in Rio de Janeiro. And as an 18 or now 19-year-old, you know, to go to Brazil, you know, I'm sure they had Brazilian bikinis back then too. So as a 19-year-old with testosterone and, you know, well, I would love to go to Brazil. What do I have to do to get to Brazil? And then, well, you have to train and swim and go fast. So, okay, that seems like a... It seems like a reasonable opportunity to get to go to Brazil. So it was really also about the training, the swimming, the competing, the representing my country and making the best of myself. But it was also about travel because I've always been a traveler. I've always wanted to explore the world. And I realized if I swam fast enough, I could travel overseas and around all over America and overseas. So it was really a ticket. Like, you know, if you join the service, you know, you get to go overseas. Well, if you join the Paralympics, you also get to go overseas. So it was a ticket to travel. And so I also took that opportunity.
Did your parents ever imagine you making it to the Paralympics?
Oh, you know, I don't think so in the beginning. You know, if you can imagine if you look way back when I got polio in Jerusalem, my parents were, you know, in their early 30s. And, you know, I'm sure all the air went out of their balloon at that time and they were distraught and distressed. And, you know, how could you, you know, imagine at that time that this terrible thing that happened to me, but also to our entire family, could turn into a good thing, into an amazing adventure that polio has provided me with these opportunities I don't think I would have had otherwise. And yes, being disabled, if you will, or physically challenged has its limitations and it has its hardships. But at the same time, I think when you lose one thing, you always gain something else. I mean, when I was 5 years old, I remember, you know, I was raised as a Catholic, but let's not let that make a big impression. But I was, you know, when I would talk to God as a 5-year-old, it was like, hey, God, you know, what's the deal here? You've taken my legs. And so what do I get in return? And I always kind of figured that there was this, you know, if he took one thing, he'd give me something else. And so I've always thought that there is a balance. If you think of Taoism and yin yang and the opposites, you know, with there always is good and bad, there's black and white, there's male and female. And so the negative parts of being disabled were balanced with a lot of positivity as well. I think one of the things in my life, I know you didn't ask, but...
No, actually, this is one of the questions, because I really wouldn't dare, if I got polio and suddenly couldn't walk at 5 years old, I would be so angry, angry all the time. I don't know how you can cope with it.
Well, you know, this is something I think that is a very a valid question. You know, what happens if you lose something? Well, I was so young and I kind of just grew up with it that I didn't have it and then lost it, which I think is a different psychological trauma than just growing up with it gradually. So I do feel that was, in a way, in a benefit, because I have met people, many people in my lives who were injured later in life. And I think there is some, it's difficult to get over that, you know, as we all do. I have recently had some challenges that are physical challenges and health-wise and things that are changing. And suddenly it's like, well, that's not fair. I don't like that. And you rebel or you push back. So, but I think I was fortunate that I grew up with it. But I was going to say too that in my life, having grown up with a disability, I do believe that I have experienced a lot of good from other people, perhaps more so than I would have had I not had a disability. I think I've seen the positive side of people much more than the negative side. I think that in a way, my disability brought out the compassion in some people, in many people, I would say. So, and that's a positive thing. I mean, anytime anything can, you know, why are kittens so popular on Instagram? Well, because they're so cute, you know, and they're so lovey, and people become, you know, soft. Mm. And that's, in our world today, to become soft or compassionate is a good thing, and the world can use more of that. So in a way, I think I've benefited from seeing the good side of people.
Yeah. in other interviews and as well here in the interview, you already mentioned your mom. Stories like you went with her to the supermarket.
Yeah.
And somewhere between the vegetables and the cornflakes, you managed to fall down. And she always waited until you got up. No wonder you became so strong.
Well, you know, that was, I think there was two sides to that story. One was her knowing what was right for me and knowing that if she took care of me too much as a kid, she would, you know, I would be weak later in life. So I think by forcing me to get up on my own, she forced me to take responsibility for myself. But the other side of that story, which is, I think, also interesting, is a social one. So society, you can imagine there she is in the store and other people are in the store looking at her and looking at me on the ground and probably saying in their minds, either out loud or with their eyes, you know, staring like, why don't you pick that kid up? You know, what's wrong with you? You know, you are such a heartless woman. And for her to be able to, you know, to know what was right to do, to not be controlled or to be influenced by the doubts of others. So I'm always saying it's always good to be deaf to the doubts of others. And she was able to do that to my benefit.
Yeah, and you even had to fight to get into school. And your dad helped you.
Yeah, that was the other one. So, you know, when I was five, we went to the local school for disabled children. And I went to the school and I remember, I can still to this day remember being in the classroom and looking around at these other children and the teachers in the class and thinking, this is not my tribe. I don't belong here. I don't feel this is my place. And so somehow my parents understood that, or I expressed that, and they say, okay, well, let's go to the regular school for able-bodied children. And so we went and we met the principal. He showed us around the school, and then he sat down and he said, you know, Mrs. Burns, Gregory's so cute, you know, but it doesn't mean he can go to school here because we have stairs, we have two floors, and there's no elevator, and no one can carry him up and down the stairs to his class. So I'm sorry, but he can't go to school. And my mother said to him, well, if he can climb stairs, can he go to school? And he said, yeah. And so she marched me home. My dad and Uncle Scott, a friend of the family, helped my father to build stairs in my backyard. And that summer, when everybody else was playing games and going to the swimming pool and running around, I was practicing going up and down the stairs in our backyard. So, you know, in September, when it was time to go back to school, my mother took me in and said, go ahead, show him. And so I marched up and down the stairs and the principal said, you know, welcome to school. Wow. So it really was an opportunity. It was the stairs of opportunity. There was stairs that I was able to climb, which got me into, I don't want to say your world, but the regular world, the world where most people live. And I wasn't excluded. I wasn't set aside. And I think that is one of the challenges in our world, is that people that are different, people with disabilities, are often relegated to the sidelines or put elsewhere. And I was not put elsewhere. My parents didn't allow that. And I became strong enough to fight for myself eventually as well. So I think that's part of why I've grown up the way I have, is because I grew up with everybody else.
Yeah. How was school for you? Did they let you take the sports classes as well?
You know, the sports classes were, I played a little bit of the sports. Like, I was a very good goalie, you know, because my crutches, I could put out my crutches and stop the soccer balls. But there was some disconnect because playing some of the sports. But yeah, I was encouraged to play sports. But I would say the greatest coach and sports experience I had was in high school, when my high school coach was a guy named Dick Jacobs. I went to the International School of The Hague, and Dick Jacobs was the coach. And, you know, he did all the gym classes.
Yeah.
And one day he came to me and he said, you seem to like sports. How would you like to, I know you cannot play basketball, but would you like to manage the basketball team, be the manager, and to do all the, you know, the paperwork and the different things? And da-da. And I said, yeah, that'd be great, because the basketball team would travel all over Europe to different games.
Wow! Oh my God!
So I got a ticket to ride again. So that was a great opportunity to be part of a sports team.
Yeah.
Our team did very well. We won the international competitions. I got my letter jacket. I was actually awarded the Athlete of the Year award when I graduated in high school. So it really was, you know, I was included, yeah, though I wasn't competing. I was completing with other people, with a team. And wow, that really was a great, an opportunity to be part of sports.
Yeah, and yeah, especially the love of sports stick
yes,
to it.
Yeah. Yes.
Wow. And did painting help you a little bit to overcome everything else?
Yeah, you know, painting, I think, is kind of, for me, it's like a meditation, even in sometimes like a religion in some way. But it is a centering device. It is a calming thing. Not always, because when I paint, if I paint a, you know, 6 by 6 foot painting with a big brush and lots of paint and a lot of energy and rock and roll music, you know, this painting is not about meditation. It's really about energy.
Yeah.
It's a sport.
Yeah.
But painting does provide a way for me to go inside myself, and it helps me to be grounded, to be centered, to be fulfilled. It's not always fun and games. I mean, people think painters just, you know, they paint a little picture and they feel happy. And that's not, you know, anything you want to be good at, there's challenge, there's hurdles, there's limitations, there's pushing, and there's failure, and there's, you know, I don't want to say trauma. It's not like, you know, getting hit in the head with a baseball, but, you know, it's, you have these limits and you have to push through things. So there's a challenge to doing art, or doing art at a different level. So, you know, I've been painting since I was 6 and exhibiting since I was 20. I've had exhibitions in 15 different countries. I've
wow,
done solo
no,
exhibitions.
17 different countries.
Seven, yeah. Yeah. and the Maldives, including the Maldives. So, yeah, it's been a great journey as well, being an artist. So an athlete and an artist, you know, you don't think of those things as really, you know, you know, when you were young, it was a doctor, a lawyer, a fireman, you know,
mm-hmm,
and but being an artist and being an athlete weren't careers, and yet they've fueled my life and travels for 40 years.
Yeah. And at the beginning, you didn't only do paintings, you draw comic books.
Yeah, well, I first started drawing comic books because I figured, why do I have to buy Dennis the Menace when I can draw my own comics? So I started to draw comics, and that was fun when I was a kid. But then I soon started to paint and still lifes, and then my one of the funny transitions was when I went to college, my freshman year in college, I went to Franklin and Marshall, a small school in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, which is Amish country, you know, very conservative community and very conservative school. And I took my first course in figure drawing, and I'll never forget, you know, 20 of us new green freshman students sitting around in a circle, and the art teacher came in and introduced himself. And then he said, let me introduce you to Mary. And Mary was a very voluptuous woman who walked into the room with a white bathrobe on and stood in the middle of the room and then took off her bathrobe. And we were doing a figure drawing and we all started drawing really fast.
did anyone look up, actually?
Only when you had to. Yeah, yeah. It was. But that, I jokingly say, that was when I really decided I was in the right place.
No comics anymore.
Yeah,
now I understand why.
So, yeah, that was a transition, yeah.
I love comics, especially like Marvel Universe stuff and DC.
Right,
do
right.
you have some favorite comics?
You know, Superman was my superhero. He was my role model. I wanted to be Superman. I wanted to be strong and, you know, I think win the day and you know, overcome evil. So so Superman was always my guy. But I like Spider-Man and, yeah, like the superheroes, yeah.
How always. About Thor?
Thor?
Yeah.
Yeah, Thor was cool. Yeah, big hammer.
Yeah,
good head of hair. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But there were no role models for you with disabilities.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That really was a... I don't want to say a problem because I didn't know it was a problem. I didn't know there were supposed to be role models for people like myself. So I didn't have anybody really to look up to say, he can't walk, but he can do this or he can do that. So I don't know how or why, but I was able to, I don't want to say be my own role model, but I was able to kind of, I don't know, figure out that I wanted to live a big life and I wanted to travel and be active and do the things that I enjoyed doing. So try to figure out how to adapt, how does someone who only has really the use of his arms ride a bicycle or, you know, ride a horse or rock climb or surf or scuba dive or do any number of physical things? You know, it's a matter of adapting. It's a matter of just figuring out, okay, how to do that. And thinking it through.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So Superman was your hero. Yeah. You had a really interesting TED Talk about the heroes or the concept of the hero's journey.
Yeah.
But actually, I think it should be called the fighter's journey.
The fighter's journey.
Yeah, because even Superman was a fighter. I think they have to put another name.
Yeah.
For people who do not know this concept, it was created from Jonathan Campbell. Yeah. And it has four main points.
Yeah.
That many or even every hero can relate to. Yep. It's about leaving your home to go on a journey, mm-hmm. facing some trials and challenges along the way, overcoming them, and then going back home to share the things you learned with others, your family, your friends, and help them overcome their own obstacles.
Yes.
Some stories we already heard about your life, but how was your life journey? How did your hero's journey look like?
Yeah, you know, the hero's journey, I think it repeats itself in our lives as well. So I don't think it's only just one. Mm. But I would say, you know, I started out in America. I figured out some things and then I left America to go to Asia to learn Chinese art, really, and painting and calligraphy. And that was my departure, if you will, from security of home and family and friends and to go into a strange world. I went to Taiwan. And it was a gray city on a gray day. It was raining. It was a mess. And I lived in a small little room with other students with leaky faucets and practiced my calligraphy on an empty telephone book. And I was miserable, really miserable for 2 weeks. And I remember making a deal with myself. I remember after a week or so I was there, I said, I just had this conversation. I said, you know, this is terrible. I hate this. Okay. I get it. And so this is back and forth. Okay, so what do you want to do about it? You want to go home? Well, yeah, I would like to go home. Well, how about we make this deal? And I basically decided that I'd give it a month. And I said if I was still miserable after a month, I would give myself permission to quit. And quitting has never been one of the high on my list of things to do. You know, quitting is not something I pride myself on, but sometimes we do quit, but I made a deal that okay, I'll spend a month, and if after a month I don't like it and I'm really miserable, I'll quit, I'll go home, I'll go back to California and have avocado and cheese sandwiches and go surfing and rock climbing instead of walking through busy streets in a city under construction and with people I don't understand and don't speak the language and see the signs in Chinese. So anyway, I decided to give it a month. And sure enough, after 3-4 weeks, I was doing fine. And it really was that fork in the road, if you will. It was that, I think we all have that. So that was my departure. That was when I left home and hearth, security. I went to overseas, and then my life journey is overseas traveling, also art, sports, working in a corporation. I did many jobs, did many things. I lived on a boat sailing from Tahiti to China, making 30-minute television documentaries. So that was the travel, the journey, the departure. And then along the way, trials, if you will, were the Paralympics. I took part in 3 Paralympics. I then transitioned into doing Ironman events. So I did the Korea Ironman, and then I did the Singapore Half Ironman 4 times. And so I had my trials, if you will, and I survived that. And then I've come back to America, and I've come back to family, friends, home and hearth, if you will, to share, you know, some of those experiences, some of the some that I've learned, whether it's my artwork or I give motivational speak talks around the world to audiences. And I also do team art events where corporations or young people, in fact, we did art workshops for Ukrainian refugees in Berlin last year and in Prague and in Serbia. So we do these, I'd say, art workshops around the world as well. So that's kind of giving back. I've come full circle, from being a kid to being an adult with some skills and some things to share, and have come full circle to now share those with other people.
Did you plan anything of this, or did you more like go with the flow? Because you told me like you planned this 2-month trip through China, and then suddenly it was 16 months later, a backpacking trip through Asia.
Yeah. You know, I was always envious of my friends or people that I saw that had kind of a program. Yeah. You know, they were going to do this and then this and then this, and they were going to get there. And I was envious because I don't know why, but my life never seemed to be that way. You know, I had things I wanted to do, and then I would set out and somehow accomplish them. But I rarely had a roadmap.
Yeah.
I've always said it's like going without knowing all the answers. And I've also oftentimes just started out on something, and life or luck or circumstance or synchronicity has created the path along the way. I don't like to admit this, I think, because I think, you know, you want to pretend that you have life under control. You want to pretend that you have all the answers.
Yeah, we don't.
We really don't.
It's an illusion.
Yeah. And I think much of my life has been that kind of, you know, put one step in front of the other. And when you get to the intersection, you know, you decide then turn left or turn right, and then go to the next intersection and turn left and turn right. And you mentioned the backpacking trip. Yeah, after my year in Taiwan studying Chinese art, I decided I wanted to go to China because I was so close. Go to China for the summer, and then I'll go back to America. So I went to China for the summer, but then the summer was over, and I was in Tibet. And I thought, wow, Tibet is nice. Maybe, you know, I've never been to Nepal, and Nepal is just on the other side of the Himalayas. So why don't I take a bus to across the Himalayas and go to Nepal? And then I did that, and then I was in Nepal for a month, and I decided, well, maybe I should go to India. And you might be able to hear the seaplane behind us right now. There's a seaplane about to take off from this little island, depositing or taking some guests away. So
it's nice to watch, actually, and the waves are so loud. I never thought that they might be so loud.
So anyway, I ended up going from Nepal then to India, and I was in India for 9 months backpacking, and then...
Was Tibet also the place where you met the Dalai Lama?
No, I met the Dalai Lama. I mean, I wouldn't say met him. I was within a few feet of him in India. In fact, I was at what's called the Kali Chakra. So I was in the middle of... I was in Varanasi. And it was New Year's Eve, I think 1985, and they had what's called the Kali Chakra, which was a huge Buddhist event in Bodh Gaya, in India, where Buddha became enlightened. And a lot of pilgrims from Tibet had come. Very funny story, yeah. You have time?
Yes, I have time, if you have time.
I have time. So when I was in Tibet, this is a story I have fairly rarely tell. I was in Tibet prior to going to Nepal and India and Pakistan. I'll finish that other story later. But I'm in Tibet, and I went to what's called the Sera Monastery, which is a monastery on the outside of Lhasa, in the mountain, right in the hills. And I went there, I just wandered in, and I found this second floor atrium where there was a painting on the wall. And I unrolled my paper and my paints, and I started to copy this painting. It was a Tibetan god, and very amazing. So I spent 3 days there painting. And I really became part of the woodwork. I mean, every day a monk would bring me a bowl of noodles, and I just became part of this. And they just left me to.
Yeah.
So 3 days later, finally, this girl I'd met in Hong Kong came by, and she says, "What are you doing here?" I said, "Well, I'm painting this painting." She said, "Well, we're taking a bus to Nepal. You want to join us?" And I said, "Okay." Otherwise, I'd probably still be there now. But I got on the bus and I went to Nepal. Anyway, 6 months later, I'm in India. I'm in Bodh Gaya. I'm at the Kali Chakra, this event, Buddhist event, with hundreds of thousands of people.
Yeah.
And I'm walking through this field, and this monk, Tibetan monk, comes up to me, and we look at each other. It's the same monk who gave me noodles every day for three days.
Yeah. What?
Yeah, yeah.
Goosebumps.
I was how does this happen? So anyway, so that
so many people
synchronicity, I mean. Yeah. So that was India. So 9 months backpacking around India, and then I think in the middle I said, well, you know, I should go back to Taiwan because I want to have an exhibition of all my paintings and my photos. How am I going to get there? I don't want to fly. I'd rather go overland because it's more interesting. I think I will go through Pakistan, and then go back through China and then back across to Taiwan. So I managed to get a train across Amritsar to Lahore in Pakistan, and then I went up to the Karakorams, Skardu and Hunza, and then over the what's called the China-Pakistan Friendship Highway that had just been opened a few months before, back into what's called Xinjiang, which is the far western China, and then back across China for 2 months. So anyway, this you asked if I had any plans in May. Yeah, no. So I had a plan to go to China for the summer, and that summer turned into another year. So I left for what I thought was 2 months trip, and I ended up 2 months in China, 2 weeks in Tibet, a month in Nepal, 9 months in India, 2 months in Pakistan, 2 months in China, back to Macau, Hong Kong, and back to Taiwan. So 16 months later, I ended up back in Taiwan. And yes, I did have the exhibition and the, painting exhibition and the photo exhibition. So yeah, but that was it just happened.
How did you carry all the paintings?
You know, good question. I can't carry that much stuff, so I had a backpack and I had my sleeping bag and I had some paints. So every few weeks or months, I would send a care package to my family in California.
Wow.
And so I would go to the post office, I'd say a prayer, I'd box up. In India at that time, it was very funny. Everything had to be put in a linen sack and sewn up. So I rolled up my paintings, my sketchbooks, and I make a package, and then you have to wrap them up in a linen bag and sew it up and put the address and stamps and send it. And then, I would say a prayer and wish that package luck and hope it made it back to America. And they did. And
wow.
I ended up, so those paintings ended up back in America. Yeah.
Never lost one.
Not that I remember, no.
Crazy. It's funny, last time we talked about all the wishes, and if you wish something and send it to the universe, suddenly, I have no idea how, sometimes it comes,
yeah. I think I've had a few experiences that way with, you make something in your mind that you want to have happen, and you throw it out like a message in a bottle in the ocean, you throw it out in the ocean, and then some years later, the bottle washes up on shore, and that's. Do you want to hear that story?
Yes, I want to.
So I'm living in Taiwan.
Yeah.
And a girlfriend of mine at the time and I were going to go to America for my sister's wedding, and on the way back to Taiwan, we planned to stop in Tahiti, in Bora Bora. So we made that plan, but I actually said to myself, I always wanted to go to the South Pacific. Live like Robinson Crusoe. I wanted to travel around on boats. I wanted to go island to island to island. I wanted to have a focus. I wanted to have a purpose. I didn't want to be a tourist. I wanted to go there with a real reason. And the other thing was I didn't want to pay for it. I didn't want to, because that would be very expensive, I think, to do that. So
it's,
I said,
it's good that you put this in the wish too.
Yeah.
Please, for free.
very economical wish. So I have a big wish, and I want it to be free. So anyway, I threw that wish in the bottle in the ocean, and it went out. And then we So we were in America. We came to Bora Bora. We're in Tahiti, and I'm staying at the Bora Bora Yacht Club 2 days. And then on the third day, I was on the jetty painting the sunset, and I met these two people. They were two young ladies, and they said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm painting. Can you see?" They said, "Oh, that's beautiful." They said, I said, "What are you doing?" They said, they pointed to, out to the ocean, and they pointed at this boat that I had seen the day before that had come in. It looked a bit like the African Queen, you know, Humphrey Bogart. That it was a very funny kind of boat. Anyway, they said, "We live on that boat." Yeah. I said, "Really? What do you do on that boat?" They said, "Well, we're part of a 10-man international crew that's sailing around the world making television documentaries. And and that's what we do." And my jaw dropped, and I said, "Wow, how did you get on?" And one of them said, "Oh, I got on in this island, and I got on in this place, and, you know, I'm the chef, and, you know, I'm the first mate," or whatever. I said, "How could I join?" And they said, "Well, we can't offer you a position, but we can. Why don't you come to lunch tomorrow?" So they invited me to lunch. They sent the Zodiac to pick me up. I went to lunch. I met the captain. I met the crew.
And then you told them, "I have a bachelor in communication."
Well, I did have skills because I was making television in Taiwan and writing. But the thing that I know, actually, looking back now, I know why they took me is because I speak Chinese. I speak Mandarin.
Wow.
And they were heading to China, and they had nobody who spoke Mandarin. They wanted, this is 1990, 91.
So
China was not as open as it is now, and people in China didn't speak as much English as they do now. So they knew that they had plans to make a lot of documentaries in China with no translator. So that's, I think, really why they took me. Not for my good looks, not for my, you know, my art skills or anything. So they said, "Okay, join me." So I sheepishly went back to the Bora Bora Yacht Club, and I said to my girlfriend, I said, "You know, I'm sorry, but I'm leaving tomorrow. You know, I'm sorry, I'm leaving you a few days early." And I left and spent the next year pretty much sailing from Tahiti to China, making television documentaries and sailing the South Pacific with a focus, making documentaries, painting, and it was for free. Actually, I got paid.
Awesome.
So it was. It really was that bottle, that wish to the universe that came back.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Yeah. We should all do more wishes.
Yes.
The other day, we were watching the video of Barcelona Paralympics, 1992. You came in second place, and it was so close. How did it make you feel seeing this video again?
Well, listen, you're talking about Barcelona 92, where I set the world record in the morning, and I got second place in the final.
This is so awful.
It was awful, but I would say it's doubly awful because what you must also remember is in 1996 in Atlanta, I did the exact same thing.
No way, like a deja vu. Oh my God.
I set the world record in the 100 meter backstroke and then lost in the final by 7/100ths of a second. And that really was like, okay, there's reasons why. One reason I know why is because in the trial in the morning, after I had swum the race and I set a world record, I wasn't tired. It was just a good race. The referee said, "Oh, you're disqualified." I said, "For what?" They said, "Because you pushed off on the turn with your hand instead of your leg." And I said, listen.
It's a little bit difficult.
It's difficult when your legs don't work. So what had happened was the referees had been the same referees for the Olympics.
Yeah.
And in the Olympics, you have to, you flip and you push off. So he had not read the cliff notes on, you know, the difference. So we protest. Yeah. And then they say, "Okay, you're right. You're fine. You didn't get disqualified." So anyway, I went, did my nap, did my thing, got ready for the final, and then I get in the water. And I did not plan to do this, but so I'm in the race.
Yeah.
The gun goes off. I'm racing to the wall. And I think just before the wall, there's a thing, don't change horses in midstream.
Yeah.
Don't change. Anyway, for whatever reason, I thought, okay, I know I'm leading my competition. I will play it safe. I will change because my new turn was the one that flipped and almost got me, or thought it got me. I will do my old turn, which is slower but safer.
No.
Yeah. And I did that. And I lost 1 second on that turn, but I lost the race by 0.07 of a second. So that was a big mistake on my part.
Yeah.
But it was heartbreaking. Getting second was not fun, but it made me, it forced me to want to try again for Sydney. So instead of retiring after 96, I again competed in 2000.
Yeah, and actually, I mean, you overcome all the setbacks. Do you have a tip for this? Like, just try again, or?
Yes, yeah.
Never change a winning team?
You know, I think, though, you know, this is, I have, yeah, though we don't always win, we always try again. Mm. And I think that's part of it. You know, we fall down, we get back up, we fall down, we get back up. And, you know, we might get tired of banging our heads on the ground, but, you know, as long as we can, we should get back up. I know in our lives, eventually, if, you know, if too much falls on your head at one time, it's hard to recover. And hopefully maybe just the recovery takes you longer. But, you know, sometimes if too many things happen at one time, you get overwhelmed. I can understand how you don't, it's difficult to come back.
Yeah.
But I'm hopeful that maybe it just means you need a little more time. You need a little bit more time to recover, to get your mojo back, to do those things that make you strong again, to take one little step at a time, take a little baby step at a time, and then take another little baby step at a time. And it's how we climb out of the holes we find ourselves in. It's like, you know, the world is falling. Yes, it's terrible. Yes. Okay. Now what? And then after the fall, after you realize where you are, you stop and go, okay, now what can I do? And try to take that next first little step, because the second one will be easier.
That's a good one. I was just thinking about how I cope with my setbacks. I always go to the hairdresser. Ah. And afterwards I go to the cinema and see an action movie. But I think your quote is way better.
Yeah, but yours is good because you can go to the hairdresser. Yeah. You know, I have no hair, so I can't go to the hairdresser. So but that's great. It's a ritual, right?
Yeah.
I think that's the other thing, is that our rituals, those things that we have, that whether it's for before a swimming meet or before a painting or before an interview or before you get up in front of a stage of 2,000 people, you have these rituals that you do that center you, that get you set, get you ready. And I think those rituals can help us in the long run.
Yeah. And you overcome your setbacks and you won at the Paralympics 2 times.
Yeah, I won 2 gold medals with the relay teams. In fact, I swam faster in the relay than I ever swam by myself.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So we set world records in Atlanta with my team, and that was really a proud moment too.
Yeah.
Because in Atlanta, you know, I've lived most of my life overseas, and I competed overseas and exhibited overseas, but Atlanta was on my country's turf, and my parents were there. My girlfriend, not the one in Tahiti, the one that I'm married to now, Angie, who's sitting right there.
So
she was there.
To be careful what we say.
she was there to cheer me on, as with my family and friends. So
yeah.
That was a really great moment to win in on my home turf.
Was it one of the 3 top moments of your life?
Yeah. For sure.
Yeah.
And then listening to Carly Simon and Uthu Indi, the band from Australia, at the closing ceremony,
yeah,
with my wife and my brother dancing in front of the stage. That was a moment to remember.
Yeah. Yeah. I always love these moments.
Yeah.
When you see they're happy and they achieved something.
It
makes me always cry.
Yeah.
What was the other 2 best moments of your life?
Best moments. You know, the physical one, I guess, completing the Korea Ironman was a tough one. I think I didn't dream I could finish it, because I never really thought about it, but didn't think it through. I just kind of did it. But that was an amazing kind of feeling of accomplishment as well. But I would say You know, there's a lot of minor moments, I would say, more than these major moments. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of minor moments. When I was in China in 2015, I was on a, there was a TV program that was called, it was called Super Clinic. Mm-hmm. And basically it was a program where they had a team of doctors and a team of philanthropists, and they would identify people in China who had medical issues. And anyway, this week's program was about a young boy who had, he wasn't diagnosed with polio, but he was a 10-year-old boy that had symptoms like he had polio. Mm-hmm. So they asked me to be kind of his mentor for this program. And we hung out for a few days, and I took him out for spaghetti. He'd never had spaghetti. And we went to my gallery in Beijing to look at my paintings. And I went swimming, and he'd never been swimming. Yeah. So it was this way of, anyway, just to be the mentor, the big brother, whatever you want to say. And to this young boy that I'd never met, and I've never seen the sense either, but, we spent 3 days together, and they made this TV program, and that really, I think, helped his life, and he got support, and I think he has a better life now. Nice. And I think being part of that was,
really cool.
I'm happy with that. Yeah. It made me feel good. I kind of, sometimes in our lives, we make mistakes, and I figure, okay, that whitewashes a few mistakes that I've made, so.
Balance.
Yeah, balance, yeah.
Did anything change after you won the gold medal, actually?
Did anything change after I won the gold medal? Not really.
But you got to go to the White House again, and you finished your career there. And you had some nice...
It's good to know that you know so much about me. This is very, very comforting. So after the 2000 Paralympics, the Paralympic and the Olympic team mm-hmm. went to the White House to shake hands with Bill Clinton at the time. And so that was a great opportunity. And so I thought, why don't I bring a painting, one of my paintings of a swimmer, on behalf of the Paralympic swim team, and present it to President Clinton. So I thought that was a great idea. So I chose a painting, got the painting, carried the painting, got to the White House, and I have this big painting under my arm, and it's quite cumbersome. And I thought, I can't carry this around. So I found an aide of an assistant, one of President Clinton's assistant, and I gave her the paint. This was not Monica, of course. This was just this girl was blonde hair. Anyway, she took the painting, and I said, by the way, when I was a kid, I swam here in the White House. And she said, really? She said, yeah. She said, okay, come here. So she took me over to is the press room now, and there was no one in it. There was no press conference. So she went over to, there was a latch and on the floor, and she lifted up the floorboard, and I looked down, and sure enough, like this ocean color here that were right below us, this lime green, there were lime green tiles, and I could see the tiles of the swimming pool.
Wow.
So they had not filled in the pool. They just put a wooden floor over it, mm-hmm. about 3 feet up, and there was the swimming pool. So I kind of claim that my swimming career began at the White House when I was 5, and then it ended that year in 2000 when I was there meeting Bill Clinton. Yeah.
Yeah. Nice memories. And it's interesting how sports and art always be a part of your life so close. And your wife is also an artist.
Yes.
How many paintings do you both have?
Well, my Angie is a photographer and a graphic designer. She would, I don't know, she has terabytes and terabytes of photos. And I have thousands of paintings and sketches. Yeah.
Where do you put all these paintings?
I have collections in California, in Singapore, in Shanghai, in Beijing, in London, and in Bali. So they're all over. My children are scattered all over the world. Yeah.
That's really nice. And traveling is also such a big part of your life. Mm. Is there any place you still want to see? I think you have been everywhere.
We haven't been to Africa. We haven't done a safari. Yeah. So. I think that would be that's next on the list. Oh, and also Machu Picchu. So I think we're going next year to Machu Picchu. We were supposed to go before the pandemic, but I think Machu Picchu is next.
It's a nice new challenge.
Yeah.
To climb to the Machu Picchu, but you have been on a mountain at a 5,000 meter high mountain. I mean, Machu Picchu will be easy.
Yeah. Well, but Machu Picchu would be the ruins, the buildings, so the architectural. I think that's interesting to me. Yeah, the mountain, the height is one thing, but Yeah, I've been in the Himalayas, and you know, I've climbed, you know, not to Everest, of course, but to from not far from Everest. I've climbed and in Nepal, and in India and Pakistan. So, yeah, I've been in the mountains and Colorado and the Grand Canyon, and so yeah, I've climbed Mount Kinabalu in Malaysia, Jade Mountain in Taiwan, the Grand Canyon a couple times. So yeah, I've done a lot of mountaineering, if you will. Not mountaineering, but climbing. Yeah.
What's the most important thing you learned about all your travels? That's a hard one at the end. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. That's good to make me think.
Can't be two things too.
Yeah, I think one of them is like people are the same everywhere you go.
Yeah.
But I've also learned that oftentimes the countries and the cultures that have the least physically have the most spiritually, in that I find in cultures, and I don't want to be too general, but when people are poor or not necessarily have abundance, is it a natural thing they make up for it by singing or by being joyous or being happy? But I've been to many places where there's poverty, and I've seen happy people, and I've seen been to many places that are affluent and seen unhappy people. So again, this is a huge generalization, but you realize that it's not what you have that makes you happy, it's what you do with what you have that makes you happy. And I think family and friends and is part of that equation of cherishing those people that are close to you, family and friends, keeping them close. And I think that's one of the, and again, if you talk about the hero's journey and the return, you know, you come back, where do you return to? You return to your family and friends. You return to those people that nurtured you, and now you nurture them and they nurture you, and it's a cycle. So I think that's that's not rocket science. It's everybody knows this, but it's just traveling kind of brought that out. And yeah, there's a lot of amazing places around the world, but it really is, it's our relationships with human beings that mark us, that make us, that make us who we really are. You can climb to the highest mountain and wow, that was a great accomplishment. But at the end of the day, it's those relationships you have that really stand the test of time and are the things that keep us strong and keep us going forward. Yeah.
It sounds so beautiful. I think we leave it here.
Okay.
Maybe we'll go and catch the dolphin cruise.
Okay.
Thank you so much for staying here.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for interviewing me. And I wish you well with this podcast and all your future podcasts. And I look forward to listening to them myself.
Yes, you will. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. We'll be right back.